I found a study during preparing for these two Sundays where George Barna just last year published a lot of information about the state of Christianity, particularly in the U.S. I won't go through it all again, but I want to give us a bit of review because I'm building on what I did last week. But he discovered that, 37 million adults have walked away from the church in the U.S. So it's not just 38 million people who don't even go to church. That's up by around 156 million adults. But 38 million adults have, in the last 10 years, left the church. And so he came up with a term called the de-churched. So what does that mean, de-churched? These are people who were not inspired to connect with a body like this, who were not having a personal encounter with Jesus Christ, who, in his words, found something better to do with their time. And I struggled with that. And like, that's more people than all of Canada that have left the church in the United States. And so what is missing? And so I was reading through 1 Kings 3, a passage that we often attribute to Solomon asking for wisdom. And I would suggest that it's pointing us in a different direction. And so last week, I did an intro of just the first couple of verses in this chapter. I didn't even give any notes. I kept posing a question to those who were here. Because I think in here, we find why so many of us struggle in our Christian faith. Why do, so many people come consistently here and just like, I'm not feeling anything. This isn't changing my life. Why isn't my life getting better? I have all these doubts. What's going on? The first couple of verses, I think, is really indicative of church culture in North America. In verse 2, it says that the people, God's people, were still worshiping and sacrificing at high places. And then we get introduced to Solomon, David's son. And it says Solomon, verse 3, showed his love for the Lord by walking in accordance with who God was and with his heart. And then there's this word, but, or except. And there lies the problem with lots of us. We want to show a love for God and walk according to his, the way that he's put before us. But, like Solomon, we offer sacrifices and burn incenses on the high places. Well, what does that mean? In pagan worship, there were high places. Not necessarily always on hills, but they were often higher elevations near a town or near a city. And they would climb up to these locations, and there would be altars there that they would sacrifice on. There'd be priests. There'd be worship. They'd climb to an even higher place, and there could be an image of a god there, whether it be a goat or a bull or something like that. And they would worship. And I drew the parallel of this is man's attempts to be right with God, that we climb these places and attempt to be closer to him. And if we achieve it, it's doing some part because of what I've done in my achievement. And so Solomon had a heart for God, but he was still doing this. But we have to be careful to not judge him too quickly because we find out where he was and what he was doing there. In verse 4, it says it was a Gibeon. I showed this last week, but I think it's important to understand the geography of all this. We're standing in Jerusalem right now. Here's the Garden of Gethsemane down here, and here's the Mount of Olives. Eastern Gate, the Temple Mount, is right here. And if you stand on this hill, you can still see Gibeon in the far distance there, about 7 miles away. And so Solomon traveled there, and the reason why is there was a high place. And it was there that the tent that Moses had set up in the desert, the tent of meeting or the tabernacle, was there. And also the bronze altar on which sacrifices were made were there. And so it kind of makes sense that he would go there from a cultural perspective of the time. So he and others would go, and 2 Chronicles tells us that they all went and they had a worship service there, as it were, and it was culturally acceptable. But God says it's wrong. And I ask the question, what are we engaging that's church culturally acceptable when God says, except that's not how it's supposed to be? And so I ask the question over and over, what are your high places? And it's a vital question that very few ask. Upon what is my salvation and my faith built on? And the application from here, that's a high place. What are your efforts to be okay with God? And I brought out, is it going to church more and reading your Bible more and serving more and giving more and doing more and more and more and more? Or is it sinning less, you know, speaking less and thinking this less and doing that less and swearing that less and cheating in this way less? All of these things form the foundation of so many people who call themselves Christians. And we fail to understand this vital question. On what am I building my faith? So many I know have lived their Christian faith pursuing something that's very much a product of themselves. And just recently sitting with them and hearing them say, I'm done. I'm done. I'm walking away from this. God's not even real. What have they missed? They haven't descended from this high place. And that's something that we all need to do. We have to descend from our higher place and come to the mercy seat. God's invited us to his very presence. And so in this passage, we're going to see how Solomon encounters God and it drives him to the very presence of God. And so what captivates a true follower of Jesus for life is not some deep religious experience and doing lots of good Christian stuff, but it's actually having a listening heart. And this is where I ended last week. At Gibeon in verse 5, he's having a dream. He's had this incredible day of sacrifice, just abundance of sacrifices. 1,000, probably a hyperbole, but many if nothing else. And we'll notice that at night, in a dream, God honors Solomon's heart, his genuine desire to love God. But he doesn't honor the sacrifices that he just made because he doesn't do it there during that time. It's at night when it's all over. So God doesn't affirm the sacrifices, but he affirms the heart. And so if you're here this morning with a genuine desire to love God and to walk consistently with him, but you just know there's things in your life that aren't right, God honors your desire to be drawn close to him, but it has to be on his terms. So in verse 5, at Gibeon, it's meant to kind of really remind us where he is. The Lord appeared to Solomon during the night, and in a dream he asked, whatever you want me to give you, I will give. Now you think that this is kind of like a great blank check. I think it's a question that is meant to draw Solomon out, to remind Solomon of God's grand purposes, and to even bring to mind Solomon's own desire to know and love God. This question also just reveals the grand story of what God is about. Verse 6 and 7, Solomon's answer, you have shown great kindness to your servant, my father David, because he was faithful to you and righteous and upright in heart. You've continued this great kindness to him and have given him a son to sit on the throne this very day. Solomon knows the promise that God has given. Back in 2 Samuel, we'll see what this promise is. David also had a heart for God. And in an amazing passage in 7, David says to God, I'm going to build you a house. I'm going to build you a place to dwell like all the other gods around us, but you'll be the great high God. And God says, hold on a second. Why do you want to build me a house? I'm going to leave that to your son, but instead I'm going to build you a household. I'm going to build you a family. I'm going to build you a legacy. I'm going to build from your story the climax of salvation. And so he says, your house and your kingdom, God speaking to David, will endure forever before me. Your throne will be established forever. This was a promise to David. And now Solomon is tapping into that. God, you were so good. Your kindness means that you were faithful in bringing this plan to bear through David. And now I'm sitting on the throne. And I just know that you're going to follow through. We're affirming God's sovereignty and what he's doing. But then in light of that, Solomon sees who he really is. Verse 7, but I'm only a little child. He's an old man by this time, or an older person at this time. But he recognizes he's just not capable of it. In the light of who God is, he sees himself and he says, I can't carry out my duties. Your servant is here among the people you have chosen. He sees who they are, a great people, too numerous to count or number. And so what does he ask? So give your servant a discerning heart to govern your people and distinguish between right and wrong. In context, this means give me wisdom to make appropriate judgments going in and out. I think for application for us today, this is the turning point. I think it's more than just knowing how to administrate something and lead a kingdom, because, I said this last week, we see this story of where Solomon starts on the high places and where it takes him. So I think it's more than he just gets wisdom to make good judgments. I think it's a transforming heart. He doesn't ask for wisdom the way we often say it. He asks for a heart that listens, a heart that God can speak into and to guide and to mold and to shape. He's humble enough to understand who he is, who God is, and what he's about. And if he wants to be a part of that for life, he has to have a heart that listens. I've been talking with some people here recently who've been struggling with this concept of God speaking to us. And I came across a story that might help you. It's kind of a fun story. I came across the story of Jerome Weidman. He was an American playwright and novelist. He was born, I think, in 1913, something like that. And one night he was at a famous New York home for supper. And a whole bunch of people were there, and he was just kind of enjoying the night. And after supper, they said they were supposed to go into this neighboring room. And so they go in, and he sees a whole bunch of musical instruments there, and he doesn't really like music. He's totally tone deaf and knows nothing about music, really. And so he was kind of bummed. He's going to have to sit here and listen to a bunch of chamber music. So everybody sits down, and they start playing, and he kind of gets lost in thought, and all of a sudden he catches himself because everybody's clapping at the end of a song, and so he kind of starts clapping. And then there's this person beside him that says, are you a fan of Bach? And he just kind of, you know, rolled his eyes a little bit, and then he looked over, and he realized that he couldn't lie. Because the strange-looking man beside him who asked the question was Albert Einstein. And so he had a pipe in his mouth and big eyes and was looking at Jerome with great expectation. And so he knew he couldn't lie, so he said, well, actually, I don't know anything about Bach. You don't? And Einstein was flabbergasted. So he said, come with me. And so both of them get up in the middle of this little concert and go upstairs in this person's home. Into a study. And Einstein looks at him and goes, so what music do you like to listen to? And he kind of sheepishly said, well, Bing Crosby, I guess. Perfect. So he looks around and he goes over to the other side of the room and gets out a phonograph and finds an album of Bing Crosby's and puts it on the phonograph and he starts to play it. And he goes, he lets a few lines go and then he stops it. And then he says to him, now sing that back. He's like, I can't sing, I'm tone deaf. Sing it back, he said. So how do you disobey Albert Einstein? So he kind of said, well, okay. And he kind of hummed a few lines back. And Einstein said, perfect. And then he ran back to the closet and got a whole bunch of more records out. Eventually brought out something like Caruso, who was an opera singer. And he would stop and say, now hum that back. And Jerome would kind of squawkingly, sing it back. And they went through, I think it was about 17 different records. And eventually he was able to hum things back almost perfectly, being someone who was tone deaf. So after that, Einstein said, finally, you're ready for Bach. And so he grabs him and they go back downstairs for the remaining part of the concert. And by the end of the concert, Jerome had developed a taste and an ear and an understanding and appreciation for this master musician, Bach. And at the end, he found himself, he said, clapping and giving applause for this little orchestra that had performed. When the owner of the home or the host who had saw them leave kind of went up and said, so where were you guys, basically? Einstein replied and said this, we were off together opening up yet another fragment of the frontier of beauty. And so he walked this person who was tone deaf and knew nothing of this genre, nothing of this language that many of us who are musicians understand. And he just took him through opening fragment after fragment of the beauty of music. And I wonder if that's a great illustration of what it's like to open fragments of the beauty of God's voice speaking to us. You know, how many of us actually see God at work in the everyday. And the people I've been talking with, I don't think they've been seeing that. The beauty of God in waking up in the morning, the beauty of creation, the heartbeat, a breath, companionship, food, work, birds, dogs, the simplest of things. Have we missed God's voice in the simple things? A listening heart is the beginning of wisdom. A listening heart is a part of wisdom. And so I want to talk just for a moment, really, what is a listening heart? God go later on and says in verse 12 that, you know, I will do what you've asked. I will give you a wise and discerning heart. So he brings these two things together. To understand wisdom, we need to look at the God of wisdom. And what is God like? And so I thought we needed to do that. If you do a word study on wisdom, we see in God that his wisdom creates creation. It leads to creation. And so God in wisdom created out of a void. And so we see in Proverbs 3, it says, the Lord by wisdom founded the earth, by understanding established the heavens. God sees absence, vacancy, and he creates. We also see the wisdom of God play out in another way. He goes into chaos and he creates order. And so in Psalm 104, it says, in wisdom have you made them all. The earth is full of your creatures. And so God, and you see this at the beginning of Genesis, after the earth was formed, there was a chaos. And into that chaos, he spoke all things into being. God's wisdom creates order and creation. God's wisdom is creative, it's purposeful, and it is good. In light of the author of wisdom, what does human wisdom look like? How are we to be wise? Well, we have to understand that wisdom or a listening heart is relational. It's not a mere gift. Last week I talked about, you know, so many of us pray for wisdom. That we, okay, package wisdom up and here you go. And you can leave with this little thing called wisdom. When God says, no, I am wisdom. And you must remain in me. You must be sensitive to my voice and my leading. And so wisdom is not a thing necessarily. But it's a purpose. It's being tapped into the character and nature of the author of wisdom. And so many people miss the relationship with Jesus Christ. So I think that's why they walk away. They've bought into a concept of who God is, but they don't have a relationship. And so moving forward, if you have a relationship, within that relationship, you have to have a posture of your heart. And the posture of our heart is one of submission and openness and readiness and great expectation. It's not just to the intellect of the mind. It's just not knowing right and wrong and what's the best way to act in every situation. But it's actually God speaking into your heart, a heart that's ready to listen, to understand what's going on and respond. So it's not a capacity to only a capacity to understand and learn and discover, but it's actually a position of humility, of teachability, of great expectation. Wisdom is also developing a moral insight. Not just containing lots of knowledge. Some of the people that are on my heart these days are way smarter than me, way smarter. They know the Bible 10 times better than I do. They can quote stuff and tell the stories, and I get paid to do this. But to them, it's higher intellect. It's more knowledge. And what they're missing is the implications of all this. Just not the information of it, but the implication. What moral insight are we gaining from God revealing something to us? What difference does this make? How is this going to change your life and change my life? What's the so what of all this? Anybody who works with me, I always push the so what. If you walk away from this today with lots of information and haven't answered the question, so what? What are we doing here? Wisdom understands God's moral character, and we understand its implication to everyday life of you and me. God's wisdom is creative. It's good. Human wisdom is humility that continues to drive us to the place of mercy. And so we see this happening with Solomon. I'm not going to get into every little part of this passage, but this is what hit me, and this is what I would love for you to walk away with, if nothing else. The beginning of this passage, Israel and Solomon, its leaders, who loves God and wants to show it by walking in accordance with his statutes, is on the high place. It's a product of him. In that place, God meets him there and gives in him a listening heart. Where does he go from there? In verse 15, jumping over some verses, I'll come back to those. In verse 15, then Solomon awoke and he realized it had been a dream. Watch this. Where does he go? He returned to Jerusalem, stood before the ark of the Lord's covenant and sacrificed burnt offerings and fellowship offerings. Then he gave a feast for all in his court. Did you catch that? Solomon is reaching up to God on his own terms, even in the culturally acceptable, day in the church. That's how he did it. And God comes in and says, listen to my voice. Have a soft heart. And immediately Solomon realizes where he wasn't, and that was in the place in the presence of God. And he immediately leaves and goes to Jerusalem. Notice that the passage doesn't put a period after Jerusalem, because it tells why he went to Jerusalem. He went to Jerusalem to meet where God was, and that is at the ark. All the other church stuff was up on the high place. God's presence was in Jerusalem. And so he goes there, and he meets his God one-on-one. This is what I think people miss. We're doing our Christianity all the time, thinking that we're relating to God, and then we come to a hard time in life, and God, where are you? I don't understand. It's because we haven't asked for a sensitive heart. We haven't met him on his terms at the place of mercy. And in Solomon's day, it was the ark. And so I want to take a moment to explain, what is the ark? What does it represent, and how does it apply to us today? Well, first and foremost, the ark was the very presence of God. When the ark was made, and finally God dwelled there, he dwelled between the cherubim on top of the ark. And he descended in a cloud. And the glory was so much so that nobody could look upon it. They had to create an innermost sanctuary, the Holy of Holies. And only once a year could a priest go in and sacrifice and meet with God on behalf of the people. And so God's presence is there. Throughout Scripture, Numbers chapter 10, you actually see that the ark is spoken of as if it had a personality or had personal traits. And it's not because the ark was some mystic chunk of wood and gold. It's because it was the very presence of God, and it was through God's presence things happened. It wasn't just the ark, it was God being there. So God dwelled with his people on the ark. It was a place of mercy. We're going to sing again this morning about the mercy seat. And what the mercy seat was the cover of the ark. It's also called the atonement cover. In Hebrew, mercy and atonement were linked. And so it's there that the priest would sprinkle blood, and mercy would be found for the sinful generation that was there. And so it was there that we can hear this declaration that you're not guilty, because the punishment has been paid for you. And so it was a place of mercy. Of course, the ark contained God's law, the Ten Commandments that Moses received. It was placed in there, and so it was the source for truth. It was the source for law. It was the guidance for how do we live in accordance with God's statutes? How do we walk in a way that's pleasing to him? And Pastor Andrew's been going through a series every time I'm not speaking, he's speaking, of playing by the rules. What does the law really mean? And it's not, just don't get angry or don't just kill somebody, but Jesus brought it to its fullest meaning. In him, in relationship, in the very person of Jesus, just getting angry as if I'm killing that individual. If I just look at someone with lustful eyes and nobody knows what's going on and I don't act out on it, Jesus said, well, it's as if you slept with them. That's bringing the law to its fullest meaning. And so it wasn't just these 10 rules, but it anticipated the person who embodied the character of God. And so it's the source for all truth, and that's what's missing in our culture today is one exclusive source of truth, of what it looks like to be human, to be male and female. Who ever thought we'd live in a day where you could put X on your passport, where you can choose anyone to marry or not marry, and so on. There was a place for truth. It was not rules, but it was the character and the nature of God. Finally, it was the power for living. We see in the story of Joshua and afterwards, we see that the ark was the power of this inferior nation to Israel, crossing the Jordan River, taking the city of Jericho, defeating the Philistines, claiming life and living life in the promised land. But we also see within that story when the nation would misuse it. They would, one, forget to consult with God and go on without it, and they would lose. Oh, yeah, we forgot the ark. And so they come back and grab it and bring it with them, and they still lost. Why? Because they were using it as some kind of magic chip when it was the presence of God and saying, in relationship to me, I will guide you. It was the source of power, not because of it being a material thing, but because it was the presence of God. This now dwells in us. I'm going to come back to that in a moment. I want to tell you a story of the power of someone who has truly met with God where he dwells. You might be sitting here thinking, yeah, but you have no idea what's going on in my life. You're right, I don't. But I came across a story, I think we were on the way back from our Mexico trip, as many of you have heard this as well, of Pastor Lim, who is the pastor of the Presbyterian Church in Mississauga, Ontario, who in 2015 visited North Korea, had done it 100 times, he said, to do humanitarian stuff. And for whatever reason was arrested this time and accused with plotting against the state and was sentenced to death. That was eventually overturned to several years of forced labor, hard labor. And so he was released just about a month ago and has just come home. The CBC did an interview with him, and I found it really interesting, the questions that they asked and what he responded and so on. But when he said when he was in prison, he had to dig 1 meter by 1 meter holes in the ground during winter, frozen ground. Took him 2 days to chip that out. When he wasn't doing that, he was breaking apart coal in a factory. During the summer, on blistering hot days, he'd work outside in the sun for 8 hours. He was hospitalized, I think, 4 times for large, long periods of time. And he describes in this interview overwhelming loneliness. He said that he was isolated for weeks and weeks, that he had guards looking at him for 24/7, 24 hours a day for 7 days a week. He couldn't go to the bathroom without someone watching him. Yet he describes this incredible loneliness and absence. And then he said, during that time, he read 100 books, over 100 books. He read the Bible more than 5 times in both English and Korean. He memorized over 700 verses. He worshiped by himself on 130 Sundays. And he said, when he did that, the discouragement and the resentment and the grumbling turned into courage, joy, and thanksgiving. You need to watch the interview, and even I wish the interview was twice as long to hear him explain that more, but I don't think he's making it up. Here's a man who's probably been in the worst situation in our present day, imprisoned in North Korea in isolation, absent from everything, and he worshiped. God was there. He came to the mercy seat, and God bring him joy. When he's asked about his anger, do you hate the Koreans? And all, no. Actually, I took it out of my notes, but no, I love them. I forgive them. And he just had a compassion. And Rosemary Barton just was like, really? I'd be angry, you know. Here's a man who has learned this concept of giving up our religiosity, this natural religion that we're all geared to, coming down off as his high place out of a heart that has been touched by the voice of God. And he meets regularly with him at the place of mercy, place of power, the place of truth, presence. That's an invitation for us. That's a challenge for us. Can we experience that today? Well, I want to challenge you, yes, that can happen to you and, you know, to me regularly. I do this because this has touched my heart. The promise and the difference for us as we leave today is that God now dwells with those who listen, who descend, and who remain. Those are the three things I see in this passage as really applicable to us. We need to descend off our high places. Understand what they are. What are you building your salvation on? Is it coming here this morning and doing this great thing and then you leave, you get to tell somebody, hey, I went to Brightview? That doesn't do anything. Come down from that place. Have a heart that will listen to the voice of God and stay there. Do you notice that in movies and stuff, they're always looking for the ark? We don't know what happened to it. Sometime when Israel was attacked and were taken off into exile, the ark disappears from the story. Most likely destroyed. Why? I would suggest to you that it was providential, that it was God's hand at work, because in the absence of this physical, something greater was coming. Jesus, to his disciples who were mourning that he was about to leave, he said, something better is coming. It's an advocate. It's someone who's going to come and live in your hearts. It was a fulfillment of the promise that God is going to dwell within the hearts of men. His law will be inscribed on their hearts. Ezekiel talks about that. When John 1 says, God was with us. He was among us through the person of Jesus Christ. The ark disappears because the sacrifice of goats and lambs and the sprinkle of blood on that thing up there was insufficient. And it anticipated, it was a foreshadow of one who was coming, and that was Jesus Christ, who was completely sufficient. He's our atoning sacrifice. It's pointing to the fulfillment of this person of Jesus. And so Hebrews, the book of Hebrews is an excellent study on this, but just one verse along these lines is Hebrews chapter 4, verse 14 to 16. Since we have a great high priest who has gone through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold firmly to the faith we profess. Let's then approach the throne of grace with confidence so that we may receive mercy, taking away the consequences of things that I have done, and find grace for the life ahead to help us in our time of need. We have opportunity today to live in a way that was so much better than Solomon, what was before Solomon. And I have a lot of conversations these days about people, you know, how do we know God and talk to God and listen to God if I can't touch him, if I can't see him? And I've struggled a little bit on how to respond to that. I've got ahead of myself a little bit, but realizing that the ark in the Old Testament was a visible, tangible symbol of the invisible God. And now I was kind of processing this, and I'm realizing that the ark is in us. The baptism of the Holy Spirit in believers and God inscribing his law on us and living in us, we have now become the visible symbol of the invisible God. That's what makes this so powerful. When a church is healthy, when the truth is proclaimed, when we come humbly, when we come with love for the sake of the other, that's what makes a community of people like this so powerful, is because we now become the visible symbol of the invisible God, that he is real. The ark would have distracted from that. The ark is us. The ark is kind of in us, that we are together, the ark. We are God's presence. We are God's power. We are God's truth. We are God's place of mercy for those who come and are looking and through our testimony discover who Jesus Christ is. That's why the church will never die and why the church is God's only one and only plan. So how do you want to be a part of that? I encourage you to come to the mercy seat. I don't know if you ever have. You know, Solomon could go to a place. Your invitation this morning is a posture. Where's your heart? What are you holding on to? Do you know your high places, and are you willing to let those go? If you don't know exactly what all that I'm talking about, go back to last week's sermons on the website. But understand your high places. Listen and come down from there. You'll find mercy. Descend that high place. Acknowledge who Jesus is. Accept mercy, this atonement, this covering, and enjoy the presence of God. But then also make sure that listening is a part of your process. So often we have this great Sunday morning experience or camp experience or concert experience, and then we leave it. It's never a part of our process. You know, we're hard of hearing. It's because we're hard of listening. We've listened once and we've moved on. The other thing is God won't speak something new to you unless you're going to listen to what he's saying to you already. And quite frankly, it's through his word. How often are you listening to him here? If you're not willing to stop, to unbusy your life, come to the word with open hands and let him speak to you through this story, why would he say anything new to you? Listening is a part of this process of journeying through the word, journeying in community, journeying through service. This story is an amazing one because of where it goes from here. The verses I skipped over, verses 10 to 14, is God honoring this commitment and giving him more than he needed to carry out the task before him. But throughout the Samuels and Kings and throughout Scripture, this phrase keeps coming up. Verse 14. It comes out in a couple different ways, but in this passage it says, all this will happen, and if you walk in my ways and obey my statutes and my commands, as David your father did, I will give you long life. When the temple is set up, when the ark is brought in, all of these things, if you walk with me, this will happen. But if you give this up, I will remove this from you. Later on in chapter 11, we see that Solomon continues to take on more and more foreign wives. And he goes back to Gibeon. He goes back to all of these other high places, and he builds altars. Somehow he lost this experience. This was a turning point for a while. He's known worldwide for his wisdom. The Queen of Sheba comes and so on. But in there, he continues just to give in to some of these vulnerabilities of his life. And it was probably women and wives, 1,000 people in your home. Yeah, that would be complicated. And he listens in and he starts to honor their gods. He didn't stay in the process of walking with God and listening to him. So what are you going to do today when you leave? What are you going to do tomorrow morning or Wednesday evening or next Saturday night? Is the process going to end when you leave the doors today? Listening needs to be a part of our journey, and God will guide you step by step. And his power, his presence, his truth, his mercy, it will walk with you. So listen as part of a process. And then finally, folks, a call for us. Let's be the visible evidence of the invisible God. And so the person I've kind of been interacting with here recently and through texts and stuff, it, when I just kind of found this wording, it was so enlightening to me, I had to text them because they've been struggling with, how do I surrender my life to a God I don't see? Look at the church. Look at the testimonies of the people that you know. That's the tangible of the invisible God that we follow. And so when you go today, be that visible evidence. Give a testimony of what God's teaching you. Tell somebody sitting around you before you get up and leave so that you've got some accountability and we do this together. And then Sundays is the day we come back together and celebrate that. What did God do in and through you this week? I've got many stories I could tell you. Not of them, all of them I have permission to. But there are stories of God doing amazing things through those who are willing to listen. We wanted to invite you to respond to this challenge and in many ways come to the mercy seat, dare I say it that way. But the way we remember the mercy that we received is through this, the table, through this act of communion, the Eucharist, and this action of giving thanks for what Christ has done for us. Jesus is our mercy seat. And we remember this to remember what he's done for us. And so I'm going to invite you to come, and if that's something you'd like to do. Jesus brought in this remembrance because of its symbolic power. The bread symbolized his blood that was broken for us, was given for us. And so we break off a piece, but we're also breaking it off from the one loaf, and that is his body. And that's what unites us together. And then we're going to dip it in the juice, and that symbolizes his blood, a blood that was shed for us. It was the blood that was sprinkled on our behalf. He's the great high priest who went into the most holy of holies, and on that atonement cover, his blood was sprinkled. It was sufficient. It was one time. Now we can approach the throne of grace with confidence. Nothing holds us back if we believe he sacrificed for me. If you've never accepted Christ as your Savior, this is not for you. Hear that carefully, because many do it because everybody else is doing it. But that's something that we'll be held accountable for. If this is not what your life is about, I encourage you to stay where you are and to contemplate and ask God what he's saying to you. If you've never surrendered your life to Christ, but this has resonated with you and you would like to, this is an awesome time to do that. Getting up with your community with some level of accountability and responding physically through a remembrance of the Eucharist. Wonderful way of surrendering your life to Christ and claiming what he's done for you. If you've done this many times and are here today needing mercy, then come. Those that would be serving, I'm sure, would be happy to pray with you, or myself after the service, or one of our elders. We're here to just pray with you and encourage you. But let's together come to the place of mercy and remind ourselves that we are now the visible evidence of the invisible God. And through my life, people can come to know who this person of Jesus is.